Blog Talk Radio.
And you're in the G-Zone with Giovanni Gelati. Gio, what's going on today?
Thank you, Big Daddy. Well, today our guests are Catherine Brakefield and Margaret Grunstein. She'll be on. Margaret will be on with us in the second half of the hour. Yesterday we had Betsy Otter Thompson on. She returned to the show after she's been on a number of times. She was a ton of fun. Tomorrow night we have the Thirsty Thursday party with Helping Hands Press. It'll be simulcast right here on the G Zone, starting at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll go at least for an hour and a half till 9:30. And you can follow along with us here on Blog Talk Radio or on Facebook or Twitter. There's going to be a ton of fun. Later in the month, June Foster, Melanie M. Jasky, Christy Cambron, Flora Regatta, Kim Vogel Sawyer. Kim Vogel Sawyer. Larry Peterson, Tracy Krause will all be with us here in the month of June. Let's bring in Catherine Brakefield. Catherine, how you doing?
Fine. How are you doing?
Can't complain. Now, you have a novel called Wilted Dandelions. Now, are you you like me? Are you a big lawn enthusiast? Do you like, personally, when I have a really nice bottle of weed control in my hand and I'm spraying the lawn, I like to kill as many dandelions, clover, as possible. Is this what this story is about? Is there a strong undercurrent of lawn care with this?
No.
No?
No, this starts in 1837 when they used to eat dandelions and dandelion soup and everything.
People still do. I've seen.
Yeah, people still do, but
they actually can dandelions and make dandelion soup and whatnot.
Oh yeah, right. It's very good. Now this begins. Wilted Dandelions begins in April of 1837 during the peak of America's Second Great Awakening. That's during when tent revivals sprang up like mushrooms, and preachers would preach sometimes for 3 days nonstop. That was there where Spencer Rachel Rathburn became so stirred, though she was a regular churchgoer, she knelt down in the dusty dirt of the tent and accepted her Savior Jesus Christ for her personal in her heart for her personal Savior. And then everything starts to change in her life. And have you ever had an awakening about Jesus Christ in your life before? I don't know. Well, I know I did. Anyways, when she receives this filling of the Holy Spirit in her, so to speak, she goes to Amity and she listens to a reverend speak about the Native Americans west of the Rocky Mountains. And she learns about Narcissa and Marcus Whitman, who are missionaries there. And she decides she wants to become a missionary. So she sends out her letter, you know, and she's for sure that God has ordained for her to be a missionary and she's ready to go. But then she learns that the Missionary Alliance will only allow married couples. Well, Spencer Rachel has no suitors knocking on her door. So then, about that same time, a Dr. Jonathan Wheaton, another missionary hopeful, learns about the restrictions, and he's desperate to find a wife, too. So Rachel receives Jonathan's proposal via her father. So Rachel is forced to agree to a loveless marriage with a man she only met twice. Go figure. So the pair starts off for Oregon to share Jesus with the natives. But then in the process, they discover that God doesn't create coincidence. He just designs possibilities. So that's where it begins at.
So after two meetings with a person, she marries him?
She marries him. Exactly.
Whoa. Whoa.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
he
intense.
Does rescue her.
Was this just some kind of a land arrangement or something? I mean, was there something that was important to both of them?
Yes, it was. The importance to both of them was the fact that they both accepted Jesus Christ and it changed their lives. And they felt this is what God wanted them to do with their life. But in order to fulfill their destiny, they had to be married. So they accepted each other this way. But I have to say, even before Jonathan realized. See, Jonathan is going to do a preliminary investigation of the land. He's going to go up ahead of the missionaries and see where they can stay, you know, where they can live. And then he finds out he can't stay there with them, though. He can only help them get there. So then he says that he wants to be part of that group, and he didn't know how, you know. But before the first meeting that he met her, he finds out about Rachel's Rachel's total fire, you know, burning desire to be a missionary. And they lock horns with each other immediately. In fact, I'll read one excerpt out of the book and explain it to you. And this is Ann Johnson's point of view. Rachel's pure innocence, her willingness to accept the unknown and to follow her Savior to the ends of the world, he couldn't help but respect her and fear for her safety. She would be safer witnessing to the poor and downtrodden of New York, not the bloodthirsty heathens in the West. You'll wilt like your confounded dandelions, wither in the harsh winters and the hot, dry summers of the wilderness, wilt and possibly die with only good intentions to mark your place on your grave. And she replies, better to wither beneath adversity than wilt in dreams of what might have been. Her hazel eyes sparkled back at him. His mind battled from present to past as he pictured her sitting beneath the budding cherry tree. That could have been the end, but for the strange coincidence of having Senator Rothburn's invitation sitting on his desk. Only he didn't believe in coincidences. So then later he finds out he can't go unless he's married. So after making her furious at him, he decides to propose via her husband, her dad, you know, which really starts off with a rocky beginning. I'll read, in fact, what one reviewer said about my book. It's in the insert of this, of Wilted Dandelions. It's from Christopher Blue, technical preservation specialist at the Western Historical Trail Center, because I had gone out to make sure my facts were all correct for the book. And I asked him to write a review thinking, well, if anyone will be accurate, you know, he'll know if I made a mistake in this book, right? Anyways, he writes this. Catherine Brakefield has carefully woven several genres of fiction into a singular, well-crafted narrative. Rachel is strong, independent, and committed to her beliefs. She is also a product of her times and susceptible to the pressure of the day, such as an arranged marriage. While reminiscent of other works, Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew comes to mind, Brakefield's work is neither derivative and is very well-placed. So that gives you an idea of the book. You'd enjoy this. Are you going to get my book?
Do both of these people that get married after two encounters, do they have parental units? I didn't catch that. Or do either one of them have a mother and a father?
You know, Jonathan's parents are both died. Rachel's mother and father are both alive. In fact, her father gives her away. Her father, I don't want to tell you the book. You have to read the book. Her father gives a sizable dowry just to have someone marry her. Because she
was
past the age of marriageability. That's, you know, so anyways. So she is, you know, really furious with everything that's going on in her life. But she still believes that God is in control. That God has a reason for all of this happening, you know. And that's the reason why she accepts this, because she still totally believes that he's going to take care of it in the end. Now, this is something I want you guys to understand. That's when I put down better to weather beneath adversity than wilt in dreams of what might have been. I believe that we all dream. I have never met anyone that does not have a plan for their future. But oftentimes we do not believe enough in ourselves to make our dream come true. And we live the rest of our life thinking about what ifs. This is what Rachel's talking about. I believe that we need our loving Creator to complete us, to help us achieve our goals. I believe that God has given each person a destiny only they can fulfill. And to find your destiny, you have to accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. Then God assigns you your position in the world's football field against Satan's team. Maybe it's just to be a disciple linebacker or a disciple quarterback, whatever you're calling. You are important to your team and God's plan. And when we wither before adversity and retreat instead of advance, we fail ourselves, our team, and God. So you see, this book is important to everybody. You know, it's not just a good read. It is a good read, but it's more. It's meant to get something out of it. And that's why what happened to Jonathan and Rachel and Wilted Dandelions will happen to Jesus' faithful followers. Those who believe enough to follow Jesus will, during their discipleship, wilt. As Jesus tells Paul in 2 Corinthians 12:9, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. That's what I believe. Anyways, and that's what the essence going through Wilted Dandelions is all about. They encounter many hardships along the way, but God is faithful. He gets them through them all. And in the end, you have to read the end to figure out what happens.
Well, I'm going to say, if you use me as the father, it would have been a short story because, like, I have seven daughters. If somebody wants to marry one of my daughters, they have two dates under their belt, or I'm going to probably do something to their person. Yeah, it would have been a short story. I would have plowed under the field. It just wouldn't have happened.
I don't know why. Yeah, back in the 1800s, I know my great-great-grandmother got married at 15. She had 11 children. And then in Rachel's case, Rachel is the eldest of the girls, and then her other sister is already engaged, you know. So and her father does not want to marry the other sister without marrying Rachel first. So I mean, it was a bad position for Rachel to be in, I know. And Rachel wanted just to leave, you know, because she's not the normal willowy, fragile type back of the 1800s. She's 5'9", you know, and she doesn't like to sit and crochet. She likes to be out out tramping in through the hills, you know, picking dandelions. So that's
Is this going to be a series type thing?
I don't know yet. You know, it depends on how well this book is received. You know, for sure. You know, to see how they like it. So far, I've had some pretty good reviews about it.
What are folks
saying? They say, I don't have the reviews on hand right now, but they say they really enjoyed it. Another person wrote, historically accurate and exciting, Wilted Dandelions is a great story of missionaries going west to minister to the Indians. Captain Breakfield creates a tension-filled tale about the Oregon Trail that is fraught with danger and a marriage that is in name only.
All right. When you started to tackle this project, was this something because of the history and all the research that you did that you needed to outline this pretty heavily, or you're more of an organic writer, or you're somewhere in the middle? How's it you all?
Well, I think I'm more plot driven. You know, I do research first, heavy in research, and then I kind of go into the plot, you know, what's going to happen, you know, what could they encounter and this sort of thing. In fact, I got a lot of my inspiration from a trip I took out west about 30-some years ago with my brother and my sisters, you know. We just traveled out just to see what it was like, you know. And we were just awed by how hard it was to travel in the station wagon, you know, let alone thinking about covered wagon days, you know. So that kind of inspired me then. And then when I learned more about the Second Great Awakening, when I was doing history books for Arcadia, that was very much involved in that, because a lot of the land in Michigan was, you know, was explored more in the 1830s during the high peak of the Second Great Awakening, when we had circuit riders ride out. I mean, they called the illiterate preachers ride out to preach the word of God. And Scottish ancestors went into eastern Lapeer in Lapeer area there, you know, to bring their children up in Christian principles. In fact, the first thing they built was a church, and the same thing out west, you know. So that was the most important thing. That was the most important thing then.
Interesting. That's very nice. But where can folks find you on social media?
Through Catherine Ulrich, Ulrich, Breakfield.com. And also my Facebook is Facebook.com, Catherine with a C, Ulrich, Brakefield. You know, through there and through Twitter and CrossRiverMedia.com. Also in CrossRiver Media, if you purchase a book from them, they do have some special gifts for them that are beneficial, you know, that you won't get someplace else. And that makes it nice, too. Let's see.
Neat. I was at your website. It looks very nice. You have a bunch of different buttons there for folks to follow you on if they want to, the different social media sites.
Oh, yes, right, I do. I'm hoping it's very accessible. I mean, I have to say, I mean, I love CrossRiver as a publisher because she's really helped me a lot with my social media. I thought just having web page, you know, was enough, and I really learned quickly that you need a lot more now with social media going on, and she's really helped me through it all. In fact, I mean, you really can't go wrong in any books from CrossRiver Media. They really do have All their books I think I've read are really exceptional and really great. I just hope mine will measure up as well as theirs did. The other ones did too. It's most, you know, I mean, I want more than a good read. I want more of a meat, you know, than anything else in my books, you know. I mean, it's important, like what Francis Bacon said once was, some books are meant to be tasted, others to be swallowed, and some few to be chewed and digested. I just pray that Wilton Dandelions will be one of these kind of books for my readers.
Now that's an interesting comment coming from a man whose last name is Bacon. I like that.
Yeah, I know it. Oh, here's another review I wanted to tell you about. It comes from Cheryl Watt, and I met her at one of the ACFW conferences, you know. And though she writes more in the modern contemporary style, she did read my book for review, and she had put down this, and I was floored. I was so happy for what she said. I was just flabbergasted. But she said, I had the honor of reading an advanced copy of this book provided by the publisher in exchange for an honest review. I was not required to write a positive review. However, I'm thrilled that I dearly love this book. Catherine's writing delighted and surprised me because I haven't read any voice like her, and I found her style very refreshing. I especially love the lyrical prose and vivid imagery, the realistic and enthralling setting, the feeling of being in the story right along with the characters who are very memorable to me. Catherine did a fantastic job making me care deeply about the characters and their journeys. I look forward to her next book. Wasn't that nice of her?
who said that?
That was Cheryl Watt.
Oh, okay.
She's a much bigger author than I am. She's awesome, though. She's an awesome person.
Nice.
Yes. I was very, very flattered by that.
Cool. So you got that feather in your cap. What do you do to relax? What do you do to chill out when you're not writing historicals?
I'm a horseback rider and a swimmer. We have Arabians. We have four Arabians right now. Two of them, and they're all under 10. They're all under 8 years old, for that matter. That's quite young for horses. But we enjoy them. You know, I mean, I've been raising Arabians for, probably 40 years. So, I mean, so we keep on doing it. Though these are my last group of horses I'm going to have, you know. Plus I have 3 grandchildren right now, 2 of which are riding horses right now, too. So that makes it exciting. And I love camping. I love about anything that's outdoor. I'm not very good indoor things, you know. I love traveling. You know, we lived in Addison Township here in Addison Township, Michigan for almost 30, 40 years. So we have to say we've had a very full life, you know. I'm more of a summer person than a winter person, though. I probably should not be living in Michigan.
Now, I didn't know horses lived so long. As a family member, they live 20 to 30 years, right?
Right. But you don't really, when they get past 25, I mean, you're very careful where you ride them. I mean, they're older people, you know, they're like us, get older people, so you don't do a whole lot of, we used to do distant riding. We used to do, we belonged to Metamora Hunt Club. We did fox hunting with our Arabs, you know. We did a little bit of everything with them. So, I mean, they've been something that, they're definitely family members. It's just amazing how much they fit into the family, you know, and, you know, when they die, it's really heart-wrenching, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they last longer than dogs, and you really have to care for them, unless you have somebody tending to the stable.
No, we take care of them ourselves, you know, we like to take care of them. I mean, they're so personable. I mean, they come to our whistle. What can I say? You know, don't you wish your kids would do that? You'd whistle and they'd come running.
Yeah,
that's what they
do.
That
would be nice.
That would be nice, wouldn't it? And they neigh, you know, they'll neigh to get their food. Do your kids neigh to praise you when you feed them? No, but horses do. You know, it's really funny. Yeah, they're really cute. And then you go in the pasture, you have to be careful because they'll all run up to you to be the first one. And they don't realize how big they are. So you have to say, okay, stand back, guys. be careful. So, you know, yeah, they just love affection. They really do. They're like big dogs.
Nice.
That's for sure.
Let me ask you one last question here as our time's winding down before we get to our next guest. Is there a question I haven't asked you or hoping I would? Maybe in your social media travels that someone hasn't asked you that you've always hoped they would?
I think this is the one here. I think the most important thing I would like readers to learn from Wilted Dandelions is God will never forsake us, will never forsake you. Whatever happens to you, God can turn anything bad into good for the glory of his kingdom. And Romans 8:28 tells us, we know that all things work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to his purpose. I won't tell you a lot, but Rachel was captured by an Indian, and that was something that happened to her that she learned very strongly. And God endures. His faith always endures, and he always has a reason for everything that happens to us. So we just have to believe him. You know, a lot of times people forget to do that. They want it their way, and they don't wait for God to come into their lives to show them what's, you know, he might have a better plan than they might have had a better plan for themselves. So I'm hoping that, as I said before, it's a good read, as I read some of the reviews already said, but there's more in this book than just having a good read. And I hope people come around and take something back with it. I think that, you know, anyone can learn from something, and I hope they are inspired and encouraged by what they read.
One question I haven't asked you that I ask most of our Christian inspirational guests is, you've spoken about the religious aspects of the book at length. How did you know how enough was enough to keep it organic in the story and not to cross over a line where perhaps folks may say it would be too preachy? Did you feel at any point in time that
I
you
know.
Took that line and you had to reel
yes.
back?
Yes. Yeah, I did. I mean, I agree with you. I thought, oh my gosh, it's going to be too preachy. But no, I mean, I just think it was, I praise the Lord, it wasn't. There's so much of a story in there with Jonathan and Rachel battling each other. I mean, they're very humanistic. You know what I'm saying? I mean, Jonathan gets very jealous, you know, with some of the things that happen with Rachel because, and it's amazing. And Rachel is very proud. And she doesn't know if Jonathan really loves her, and she loves Jonathan. I mean, it's just amazing. There's such a conflict between the two of them that it's so funny. It's a lot of humorous things that happen in there that the reader will get attracted to. You know what I'm saying? It's not preachy. I have to tell you that. You know, and though it is about missionaries. You know, but these people are very down to earth. I mean, they are very just like you and me. I mean, no. Can you imagine meeting your wife and not proposing to her and just at the second time and then you're going to get married, you know, and you know, go to bed together. Can you imagine that?
No, not really.
No. Right. Neither can Rachel. You got to find out what happens.
All right.
No, it's very humorous. You'll like it. You should read it, I'm telling you. Especially with seven girls, boy, I tell you.
I want to thank you for being on the show today. It's been a true pleasure.
Everybody,
Catherine
that.
Brakefield, author of Wilted Dandelions. Look for her on her website or on Amazon. And please, pick up her novel and enjoy it. It sounds like a very nice read. I want to thank you for being on, Catherine. You're more than welcome
thank you,
back anytime.
And God bless you. Yes.
Thank you. Have a great day. Everybody,
okay.
I want to play an audio sample of, let's see how much time we have. I'm going to play Patty J. Smith's Grave Obsessions audio sample as read by narration by George. And then on the other side of this, we're going to have Margaret Grunderstein on. So here we go. This is Patty J. Smith's Grave Obsessions.
Helping Hands Press is proud to present Grave Obsessions, Volume 1. Chiseled Heart by Patty J. Smith. This police mystery begins with a case that unnerves the most seasoned veterans on the force A witness interview leads Detective Dallas Keegan and her partner to evidence that puts the investigation into overdrive. He is not done. Her personal life unravels as she hunts down this demon while fighting her own. Readers say, I love the pace of this story, keeps you on the edge of your seat as you read, and the descriptions are written in a you are there style. Reading this is like watching an episode of Law and Order. Great read, another reader says. This book kept me on the edge of my seat from start to finish. And finally, a reader writes, good mystery, some spiritual guidance. Let's listen to an excerpt from Grave Obsessions, Volume 1, Chiseled Heart. Arriving at the complex, Dallas was forced to slow the car to a crawl in order to dodge the crowd of concerned neighbors and looky-loos clamoring to get close to the action. Once parked, she and Bennett ducked under the yellow crime scene tape and flashed their badges to a uniform stationed outside the apartment. As they entered, their latex gloves snapped in unison. The living room was sparsely furnished, but tidy, no indication of a struggle. An unopened backpack lay on the couch. A yellow light blinked from the answering machine on the kitchen counter. Dallas made a mental note to pull the messages before leaving and headed down the hall. The stench of death permeated the air. A crime lab technician came out of the bedroom carrying a camera. Whoever did this was psycho, that poor kid. The first image was that of small feet, one covered by a slipper, the other bared. The medical examiner, standing over the body, moved aside so they could get a full view. Dallas cringed. The victim was on the floor next to her bed in a t-shirt and boxers, saturated with blood that had pooled around the body. Her facial expression was frozen, mid-scream, eyes wide open, staring blankly at the ceiling. Below the chin was a gaping slit that went ear to ear, resembling a macabre smile. What came next sent chills down Dallas's spine. Carved on the right cheek was the word, "My." On the left was a heart. The ME continued the exterior examination, and Dallas focused on the rest of the room. Similar to other areas in the apartment, there was no sign of a struggle. It was quick, she said aloud. She was blindsided. A breeze flowed through the open window, leading to a grassy hill down the street. Easy in, easy out. She tapped the ME on the shoulder. We'll let you finish up here, Doc. Crap, the guy left a signature, Bennett said. Hope I'm wrong, but I have a bad feeling about this. Dallas nodded in agreement. She went to the kitchen and pressed the playback button on the answering machine. All the messages were from that morning, asking her where she was, including one from an obviously distraught mother. Suddenly she zoned out, unable to focus on anything. The sound of the backpack being unzipped brought her back to the scene. The only contents were a purse and a red apron. He poked around the purse, locating the wallet and driver's license. A name is Camille Garza. Then with a heavy sigh, Keegan, the kid's only 22. Returning everything to the pack, he left it on the couch to be bagged and tagged. He stepped outside to call the lieutenant with an update. Meanwhile, Dallas located the officer first on the scene. He conveyed the landlord's account. She asked if the guy was nearby, and the officer pointed towards a man sitting in a golf cart, visibly shaken. She approached him with an apology for what he had experienced, as well as having to answer more questions. The crowd was growing, and several demanded to know what was going on. An announcement from a squad car speaker quieted them down.
People, please, we just started the investigation. Go home. We'll be interviewing residents later, so if you witnessed something last night, give one of the officers your name and address.
Moans erupted, but eventually everyone complied. Several walked off the property down the hill towards the strip mall. He was among them. A frown formed as he thought to himself, wrong, wrong, wrong. A sample from Grave Obsessions by Patty J. Smith, Volume 1, Chiseled Heart. It's from Helping Hands Press at myhelpinghandspress.com and narrated by George Taylor of narrationbygeorge.com.
All right, we're back. Catherine Brakefield was with us in the first half of the show. Margaret Grunstein will be with us in a second. She's waiting in the wings. Just a little bit about George. He's going to be at a pretty big event this weekend, narrating some it's not Hemingway. Anyway, there'll be a blog post about it tomorrow on Helping Hands Press website, and it will be the focus of his podcast, which will be played in its entirety tomorrow night and also on Saturday morning. So I'm looking forward to that, listening to George talk about the festival. He was invited to speak at. It's pretty big to-do in the audio world. Let's bring Margaret Grunstein in. How you doing, Margaret?
Good, great, thank you.
Looking at your bio here, you're kind of like a Swiss Army knife here. Your book is about the 70s. Then you shifted over to photography and director of a preschool, and you're also a psychotherapist. What's a psychotherapist do besides take care of folks that are kind of not right-minded? What's the difference between a psychotherapist and a psychologist and stuff?
It's just a different degree. A psychologist is a doctorate, mine's a master's. But I think it's not so much people are not in their right mind, but we all go through stressful periods, through divorces, through losses, through a desire to grow, complications raising children, challenges happen in our own life with illness. So couples need work. So my work there really is helping people find their best selves, truly, and the best path. I believe they have it in them, but through talking and having it reflected back in the relationship, that people grow and can move through their life with a little bit more assistance than just friendship can bring.
Interesting. Now, do you put that all to work with the preschool? I mean, you mess with the little kids' heads or what?
Well, even every parent messes with their child's heads. I mean, you know, we teach them values. You teach them about the world. Both things feed on each other. You know, the preschool is, it's a wonderful gift to me. Everything, all of life comes through early childhood education, and the pleasure of being able to help parents do that and the thrill and the joy of doing it with the children. And every child is wired differently and has a different way of being in the world and how do we understand them. But I'm very aware that at the preschool I get a normative base, but I'm not doing therapy. In my therapy practice, I certainly am enriched through the experience I've had in early childhood and with parents, but I have a deeper role to go in. One informs the other, but they're very different.
You say all that. You sound really, really grounded, but your book is about like some wild times back in the day. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Now, do you feel that experience back then helped you define a different path later in life or what?
Well, they may sound contradictory because the book, I'm not sure, you know, what you may have said about it, but, you know, I left graduate school. I was in a prestigious graduate school headed for great success, and it was a time, 1970, the goal was to, it was still a goal for finding, the desire was to find community, to be a part of something larger than myself, to be connected with other people, to try to live a righteous and good life. As much as the times are understood now as they're seen in their more licentious and sensational aspects, I think hopefully the book carries a sense of that there was an innocence and a desire to bring changes. And in that sense, the preschool is a continuation of it, but slightly more realistic. That I have a community there. I have, I'm trying to bring, one of the lovely things about a preschool is that when we say if something friendly or not friendly, it means something. And I think we were really trying to believe what we felt at that time were friendly values. How do we respect each other, not by class? And certainly there were explorations and things that were a little more actually commonplace now, but a little bit more radical at that time. So I don't see it as quite as big a separation, although historically that was a tumultuous time, and I was able to participate in it.
Looking back then and now, you know, you're talking about a sense of community and relationships and stuff like that. If you took somebody like your, if you were talking to yourself, you know, looking at the 70s you and now you, with everything that goes on now with communication, whether it's by text, email, etc., folks think that, you know, you can basically touch anybody in the world. You can have a sense of a different kind of community, but it's not a personal community. Would that be something that your study self would have railed against today, that it's too impersonal, or do you find that it's apples and oranges?
No, it's a good question. You know, in the 70s, who could have predicted what was coming? When I grew up, the idea of a telephone, first that you could carry in your hand and walk around with, and that you could have a picture on it was ridiculous. You know, I mean, as a teenager, we would laugh, and what if, you know, you could see somebody, you know, while you were talking with them on the phone, and we'd have to take our curlers out and look good every time anybody called. So the technology and the changes in communication in my lifetime are beyond my comprehension. But I think that there is a universal desire to truly connect, not just through Facebook, not just through tweeting, not just through saying, you know, chatting with the checkout counter person, but to have long, enduring, intimate relationships that are satisfying. I see that as friendships build in the young children in my preschool. That's what makes it satisfying, that they have their good friends and their effective friends and they can play well, that the community of parents that are built. I think that need, I understood it then instinctively. I understand it more through experience at this point in my life. And I think it is still a very strong and powerful need that people long for.
Yeah, I personally feel bad. Like I don't go out to dinner a ton, but whenever we go out, see a family sitting at a table and none of them are speaking. They're all just like looking at some type of device and there's someone forefinger just flapping around, and I just think that's like such a waste of time. But some folks, that's their life.
And you're right that even though you can be in a family or in a relationship, it can be a very lonely spot. When I lived in that community, you know, and it was a very unstructured community. Most of the people, not me, were artists or architects, and every ego was too big. There was no big follow, you know, big leader or great, you know, we sort of ad hoc and tried different things. But I loved, we got to know each other. And those friendships still exist, and with an intimacy of the knowledge. You know, it's like a marriage. When you live day in and day out with somebody, their shell falls off and you get to know the essence of them. And you've also shared experiences and have a history together. So intimacy comes in many different ways. And I'm not talking about sexual intimacy. I'm talking about the real sense of being together, knowing each other, sharing good times, going through some hard times, seeing everybody with their defenses up and their defenses down, and still liking each other and hanging in there. You know, it didn't work. I had been in a marriage that didn't work either. But there are great relationships that do work, and great relationships, and I'm part of communities and friendships, and my own daughters and my granddaughters are children. So it's a powerful thing, and it comes in different forms.
So what was catalyst for the project? What made you tackle it?
Well, I have to tell you that. I wish it was more linear. I could tell you it was more linear, but it wasn't. I was in graduate school from 68 to 70. It was a time of great student activism, taking over schools, fighting for more civil rights, against the war in Vietnam. And certainly I got very involved in that in my own graduate school, to the point where I even wrote a letter as part of an ad hoc admissions committee for the city planning department, admitting a young man of color into our program. And about 3 days later, the president of Yale sent a letter to him saying he was not admitted to our program. But Kent State
State happened at that time when students were shot. I think the government was fighting back. I saw tanks and, you know, the National Guard in my own backyard walking down the streets of New Haven. It became clear that if we wanted to live by different standards, direct confrontation was not going to take us there. We needed to find a place and kind of drop out and live the life we wanted to live. And my husband at the time was a very charismatic man and very political, and he was kind of a strong leader. And we headed west with a bunch of friends in different vehicles at different times with no particular direction. And bit by bit, we found our direction. We, you know, stayed first in our apartment. Then a bunch of us, my husband went out with a bunch of people, and they rented a farm, and we all moved to the farm. And then one couple bought 160 acres with nothing on it. And when I say nothing, there were, you know, again, the no phones, no media, no plumbing, no water, no electricity. You know, if you wanted to make dinner, you chopped down a tree. That's how, you know, that's how basic it was. So we just morphed as situations presented themselves. But I think my husband was probably the mover and shaker in terms of the ideology of trying to share money. But the times also created their own ideology.
And what came of that struggle? What was the end result for you?
Of the adventure?
Yeah.
I had five of the most wonderful years of my life. Not to say the rest of my life hasn't been wonderful. I'm a very blessed and lucky woman. And even at my age, I have new adventures. It was an adventure that opened me, took me out of just a very narrow vision of what was success and what was satisfying in life. It brought me in contact with the natural world and a greater sense of a community and not being afraid to take a chance. And for that, I'm always grateful because my first husband really opened that door for me. And when I was, you know, moved back and clawed my way back into the middle class, I had my children and was struggling financially, I knew I'd had that glorious time in my life. And that this was my time to buckle down and do some other kind of work, to be a single parent and work hard and raise my daughters. It was just a glorious period in my life, just as this is in a different way.
So do you think that it emboldened you for the rest of your life to do different things, or it was just something that gave you a greater sense of confidence as you've gone through life?
Well, I think it taught me that you can. It taught me some hard lessons, which were when you walk away for 5 years and you spend a lot of money getting yourself all primed to get into a hot career, when you come back, no one remembers that you're there and you have no skills that you haven't built for those 5 years that are going to help you. And that making a living is hard business, important business, and does need to be taken care of, and not to sneeze at. You know, it taught me also you can step outside something, you can take a chance, and you can have a glorious time in it, and then you can try something else and take a chance in a different way. Writing this book was taking a chance for me, and it did. I also learned that I could do things, you know, when I had to build my own cabin with a lot of help from people or survive under circumstances that I never anticipated. I said, I did it. And I could survive the loss of my husband. I could survive, but I was also held up by a community. So there are life lessons that, not one lesson, I think, but things that just subtly are woven through as I live the rest of my life.
That's pretty intense. What kind of reaction are folks giving you on the book?
You know, it is so funny. People of my generation read it and they say, "Oh, I remember that," and it evokes that their history. There's a young woman at my school who, a teacher who's from an Eastern European country, and when I spoke of the tanks and the coming down the streets of New Haven, she remembered that from her lifetime. Some people see the bigger picture and the search for that they're in their present day life. How do they find what I was seeking then? Everybody finds their own story in it somewhere, but it is a historical document.
Nice. So you wove history through the book as you lived it and recalled it.
Could you say that once again? I'm sorry, I missed.
I said you wove the periods of history through the book as you lived through it and recalled it.
Yeah, I always saw it as, when I first started writing it, I said, it's time for my generation to tell our stories. And I was lucky enough to actually have immersed myself in and to have been born when I landed in came to age and during a very convulsive and important period in American history. And I took the leap and jumped in full bore. And so I had a story, somebody doing their PhD on mid-century American history may look at it as a first-person source somewhere along the line. but I just felt it was time to put my story out.
Nice. Are you going to follow us up with anything?
Well, I am going to be working on something. I'm 71 now, but I'm still full of new adventures. And I've got a second book up my sleeve that has to do about being a woman at 71 and some certain aspects of that, which I hope will be just as vital, just as exciting, and just as much of an adventure.
Wow. That's pretty cool. Where can folks find you on social media?
I have my website, which is my name, Margaret Grunstein, GRUNDSTEIN.com. So it's MargaretGrunstein.com. And on my website, I've got readings in Portland and Berkeley and Washington, Seattle and just different places across the country. There's notes about that, my history, different articles. The book is purchased at a lot of independent bookstores, regular bookstores, online, Amazon. But the website's the source of most of the information.
Interesting. What happened to the folks that bought all the acres that had nothing on it? What are they doing now?
Well, they still have land up in Oregon where they spend half the year, and they sold that particular piece of land and moved to one that had electricity and running water, but built a house there, and it's close to some families or some cluster of people who were in another group, another communal group that was near us. So some of the ties for them are still connected up in Oregon over all these 40-odd years. And others have, we were international. Some have returned back to Greece, others. But the couple that bought the land, they sold that land ultimately and bought land that was a little bit less like a national park. And part of their time there. Yeah.
I thought you were going to tell me they opened a winery and they're just... no? Okay.
No. Nah. No.
Have any of the folks you traveled with taken a look at your book?
Well, I did. My original idea was kind of a communal telling of a communal tale, and I wanted everybody to write part of it, and so you'd have different points of view. But that didn't work out, and ultimately I had to learn how to write, which I'd never done before, and do it myself. But I did try to run it, but I interviewed almost everybody in the book, and I'm sending out copies to them as a gift for their help, and some of them have read it in a draft form. And I've tried my best to carry, bring as much balance and insight and fairness to how we all participated and where all our strengths were and where all our vulnerabilities were. I haven't, not everybody has given me feedback, but many have and feel that it was fair and covered my vision of the story, and they're happy to have it out.
That's pretty neat. The whole project's very intriguing. I think that there's a lot from what you said. I think it's pretty cool, whether it's historical or not. Someone's life journey is very interesting.
Well, thank you. I was so worried that it would just be seen for all the sensational aspects of that time and the sex, drugs, rock and roll kind of thing. But I wanted to dig deeper and say, that we weren't just two-dimensional. And when you say the word hippie, you think, oh, peace, love, drugs, And I wanted to say that really everybody had a different story, but my journey, there was really an effort and I think a dream on all of us from different ways to try to touch something that was bigger. And how do we do it? We may have been innocent and we may have fumbled and not done it particularly perfectly, but we're human, and that's what I also had to learn. We're human. We're not perfect beings. We're not angels. And our feet are made of clay, but we tried. And I'm so glad we did.
Neat. Now, are there any Forrest Gump moments in there where you meet different celebrities or people at different points in their life that do big things? Have you have anything like that in the book?
Well, there were a lot of odd adventures. You know, we were, our policy, of course, was that it was open door, that no person was better than anybody else. And there was kind of like a hippie underground trail, you know, underground railway almost, that people would, and they knew they could get free food or a free place to stay or pitch a tent or whatever, which meant you got a lot of odd people as well. And sometimes they were surprised by us, because we were educated, and other times we were surprised by them. There was some young man who clearly was under some mental distress, and we were having a celebration for a solstice or something, and we had cooked, we got fish for, you know, 25 cents a pound down at the ocean, and we cooked in this huge tub over the fire and put it on the tables to have this whole communal feast, and it had cooled down a bit, and I remember he stood up, he stood on the bench, he rolled up the cuffs of his pants, you could see his little hairy legs, and then he just stood on the table and stepped into the soup and started howling at the top of his lungs. So, at which point, two of the larger fellows from our group picked him up and escorted him off. And we heard rumors of some things that were very off with him. So you never quite knew what was coming through your door. And so the open door policy sometimes, you know, had its risks.
So saying that behavior was not normal?
No. No, no, absolutely not. You know, we were a very civilized group, you know, but by opening our doors and trying to be absolutely egalitarian and not exclusive, and we'd come from exclusive institutions, so a lot of odd people did walk through. But as a group ourselves, you know, two of the guys there, they're father had been an Episcopalian minister in Texas. You know, my husband came from a very well-connected family in Indonesia and in the UN, and, you know, it doesn't necessarily make us better or worse than anybody, but our doors were open to, but there was also wonderful camaraderie with other people in other groups who had totally different backgrounds, which was also wonderful. And there were just great events being together with each other, sitting around the table with a kerosene lantern. You'd all sort of scavenged, figured out how to make dinner, and someone had chopped the wood, someone had lit the stove. You know, the lights, you know, it's dark outside, and you just feel in the center of the universe with everybody you love and care about around you, and not everybody, but most of them, and that you're in the beautiful scenery of the woods, and you've done it together. And it feels
really
beautiful.
Yeah, what began the end on that?
Well, I'll take the risk here of spoiler alert, but you know, you can only go so far out. The economy goes with you. Money's a powerful thing, and ownership of the land became a big issue. And at the time, I didn't understand, because I didn't have vested interest in it, except that I lived there and saw my future there. But I think the battle over ownership of the land and where that took us, and as an adult later, as you know, a more mature adult later, as I'm writing the book, I understand the role and the importance of the investment in the property and have a different perspective on it. At the time, though, you know, money's a big issue. How do we share it? And if we've earned it and we put it into something, how do we protect that? It's a hard issue in marriages. It's a hard issue in a community.
Wow. That's pretty cool. Very
I want to tell you, you've asked very good questions. You're a wonderful interviewer. Very, very good questions, at least to my way.
You're way too kind. I mean, I think most of these questions just, I'm not that bright. I think they just kind of presented themselves. I mean, they have a life experience like that, and the passion that you have for it, I think, is pretty intense. I mean, you seem to have taken the best and the worst from it and made a lot of it, and some people take experiences and don't really use them in their person. They kind of discard them or shove them somewhere in their mind and not go to it. And you seem to really have embraced it and taken a lot from it. And it's very nice.
Oh, well,
very refreshing.
Thank you. Oh, well, thank you so very much. I mean, who wants to live in bitterness? And, you know, it takes me back to the therapy work also. And we're just given this one life, and I want to live it with as much enthusiasm, you know, with as much involvement and as much openness, and to continue to grow until I'm just not able to anymore. So why not embrace it?
Yeah, I mean, those experiences you had then, do you think dealing with all those different people that came through that community that you had then, and your acceptance of them, trying to see them as who they were, you know, raw without any strings attached, has that helped you in your psychotherapy work to try to see people for who they really are, not any of the walls that they put up? Has that helped you with that?
I think, you know, every life experience builds on itself, and you get deeper and, you know, deeper and deeper understanding. Yes, and I also think my work, you know, I've done the preschool for, I don't know, 37 years. I know the gift of the preschool is that our job is to receive every child that comes in there, and it sounds corny, but to receive them in our hearts, and each one is different. And one may have a little bit more trouble settling in the world this way, and another one may have a different way. They're all different. And I'm a parent, and, you know, I'm not sure if you are, we're given children. And how do we meet that child that we're given where they're at? Hold them, embrace them, love them, and then challenge them to grow the best way we know how. And so my work in the preschool, that is really the essence of it. How do we, when someone entrusts their child with us, embrace that child, and whether they're quiet, whether they're a little bit, it's harder for them to figure out how to be a friend, whether they're bold and rambunctious, whether it's harder for them to sit. And then we take that, I take it that same thing as a therapist. Each person comes to me in such a vulnerable state and entrusts me with the journey of their intimate life. And so to just meet them there and embrace that, and certainly that's what we were trying to do, and certainly, you know, as we, the people we love, my own daughters, my grandchildren, my friends, that certainly is an effort, too, to, but you also have to find in personal life who's the right combination for you.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. Now, I have my wife and I have eight kids, but they've lived a different life. It's truly a dictatorship, so they understand that. There's no hope. There's no hope in this dictatorship either. There will be no tanks.
Revolution. Yeah,
any tank that tries to come down the road, trust me, I meet it with force. So it's a true dictatorship, and we squash any rebellion that tries to come our way. It's worked, so I'm pretty pleased with it. But yeah,
absolutely, and I think boundaries, expectations are very important. But I'm sure even within the dictatorship, you sort of have to know who are the different people you're dictating over, and how to manage them a little bit.
Yes, there are no civil liberties here, no freedom of speech. It's all stripped and removed from the get-go. So this,
okay.
Once that line is established, everything else falls into place. I don't know if any child would thrive if I had a daycare, which is probably why I've never got into the daycare business. So that's fine.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody would ever bring their kid to our daycare. So I'm okay.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Well, I do believe in firm expectations, clear boundaries, and that there's a bottom line on how we treat each other. So, you know.
Yeah, I think if you're a child, give them some walls and some freedom. I think they'll do what they'll survive and do well. And my father gave me advice before our firstborn. He said, "Always remember, they will survive and thrive despite you." And then that has been a great piece of advice I've always held on to. Very wise.
That's lovely. Yeah, very lovely. Yes. Yes. It does put it in perspective, doesn't it?
Oh, I think so. I want to thank you for coming on today. You're more than welcome here anytime you'd like to stop by, all right?
Oh, thank you so much. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Pleasure's mine, totally. Everyone, Margaret Grunstein. Earlier in the show, we had Catherine Brakefield. I hope everybody has an awesome day. I can't thank everyone enough that's on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, StumbleUpon, Tumblr. I want to thank everyone for sharing the show and helping others try to find an author new to them. Can't thank you enough. Tomorrow night, we will be on at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to be simulcasting Helping Hands Press Thirsty Thursday party. So whether you're here on Blog Talk Radio or on Facebook or Twitter, we hope to find. Hope that you're there and you're having fun with us. I hope everybody has an awesome day. Margaret, thanks a lot for being on the show again. And thank you, Catherine, for being on earlier. Everybody have an awesome day. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.